is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Some interesting headlines here on the front page of the New York Times. I can't be forgiven for Abu Ghraib. I was a former interrogator in Iraq. I was not surprised by the torture report. Obama avoids taking sides on effectiveness of CIA methods. I mean, basically what this has come down to is this whole thing with this torture report that came out yesterday is this shouting match between there's really a couple of two parties on the right-hand side of this who have somewhat different agendas, but they're finding some common ground, okay? You've got the people who want to protect the legacy of Bush and Cheney, which is essentially the entire Republican Party. They do not want history to look back on George W. Bush the way it looks back on, for example, at least with regard to the economy, Herbert Hoover. They don't want the country to look back and say he was the guy who blew it. Or they don't want the country to look back on George W. Bush the way that it looks at Lyndon Johnson with regard to the Vietnam War, or Richard Nixon for that matter. So they're trying to maintain a legacy for a Republican president who committed crimes while in office. And so they're trying to say, well, either A, those crimes were justified, or B, those crimes actually were successful, and maybe we should, you know, have a conversation about using this stuff in the future. That's the subset. Okay, so the first party to this debate on the right are the Republicans, the partisan Republicans. This is why Mitch McConnell came out and said, it was a terrible thing
that we're releasing this report. It's going to cause people to shoot at our troops.
Like they wouldn't do it if they could anyway, right? The second group who have a personal agenda here is the CIA. You know, they committed these crimes. And the only defense that they have, I mean, there's basically three possible defenses for the CIA. The first is the one that they should do and they're not, which is, yep, we screwed up. We're going to hold some people accountable. Some people are going to lose their jobs. Some people are going to be demoted or fired. Some people are going to be jailed or court-martialed or whatever the CIA equivalent of it is. And we are changing our policies and we are cleaning up our act. That's what they should be saying. They're not. Which is, I think, you know, a sad day for America that they're not. The second position the CIA could take is in their defense, is yes, we did it, but we were told to do it. You got a problem with it? Talk to Dick Cheney. In fact, I saw an extended conversation yesterday on Fox or on CNN between Wolf Blitzer and the guy who was the CIA's lawyer at this time. And he said that he briefed Dick Cheney personally repeatedly. Dick Cheney was very much in the loop and knew everything that was going on. Nobody, to the best of his knowledge, ever talked to George W. Bush. So Bush was, you know, George W. Bush, one of his favorite comments is you have to trust the judgment of your people. Apparently he trusted the judgment of Dick Cheney, who was a megalomaniacal torturer deep down in his heart and still is. So anyhow, the second defense that the CIA could offer is, yeah, we did it, but we were told to do it. So the responsibility isn't ours. We just do what we're told. Talk to the people in the White House. You know, there's civilian oversight of the executive branch. It's the president, the vice president. The third defense that the CIA could make, which is the defense that they are making, is the most horrible of the three, which is, yes, we did it, and it worked. And the reason that's an insane defense is because once you start asserting that torture works, you are telling every police agency, every government agency, not just in the United States, but around the world, in our opinion, as the preeminent spy organization in the world, we officially assert that torture works. Shouldn't use it, but it works. and countries that didn't come out of the Enlightenment of the 17th century, 18th century, countries that, you know, might be inclined to use torture anyway, they're now going to say, oh, you know, we need to do more of this. So this is just the most wrong argument that can be made. But these are the arguments that are being made on the right. Now, the arguments on the left, as it were, and I'm not sure that right and left actually apply here, because I had two conservatives. I had a libertarian, Mark Harold, and a conservative, Shelby, I'm forgetting her last name, on the program, on the TV program last night. And they were both, yeah, this was a terrible thing. Never should have happened. This is not consistent with American values. But the arguments on the, let's shall we say, left side, just for shorthand, are we should be prosecuting the White House, who ordered the CIA to do this, and we should be prosecuting the CIA, because at the Nuremberg trials, when people said, I was just following orders, we said, tough luck. If you're following an order and you know that order is a crime, you're supposed to say, I refuse to follow that order. We hung people for saying, I'm just following orders. And we hung them based on a set of rules that were written by Abraham Lincoln in April of 1863. April 24th, 1863, Abraham Lincoln said, here's the deal. And that became incorporated in 1898 into the first Geneva Accords. His rules for how the Union Army should treat Confederate soldiers. So number one on the left, we're saying, yeah, we need to own up to this. We need to own it, and that will strengthen America. It will assert our values. You know, it says something in my mind about the character of the Mitch McTurtles of the world. Contrasted, by the way, contrast Mitch McConnell's, you know, partisan. I mean, he's totally about partisan politics and destroying anything to destroy the Obama legacy. There's something really extraordinarily almost sad about the contrast between what Mitch McConnell said and what John McCain said yesterday. Two conservative Republicans. John McCain got up and said, I was tortured. It doesn't work. If you want, I mean, you know, in fact, I mean, McCain didn't say this, but this is a fact. Torture was not invented to get useful information. The reason that they had the Star Chambers, the reason when you travel through Europe and you visit these, they have museums of old dungeons and old castles where you see the Iron Maiden and these iron face masks that have little spikes in them. Body things that spike, you know, the chains, the torture devices, many of them, by the way, sadosexual in nature, which takes us back to the CIA sticking feeding tubes up the butts of these guys and feeding them, that way as a way of humiliating them. The thing that you learn when you go through these museums in Europe is that they weren't trying to get actionable intelligence. They were trying to get false confessions that they could use to do whatever they damn well please. They needed somebody to say, yes, that guy, my political opponent, that guy is trying to overthrow the country. So you're justified in cutting his head off. Or yes, Marie Antoinette has, or not Marie Antoinette, who was Henry VIII's fifth wife? Mary, somebody, Mary, whatever. Yes, she was sleeping around. See, it was all about forcing confessions where the torturer knew in advance what he wanted. We'll be back with this, and I want to pick up your thoughts on this, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But mostly I want to push back on this right-wing meme. I'm going to play some clips for you in a minute to illustrate exactly what I'm talking about. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Oh, I was hearing a lot of people last night, just yesterday, saying that if we investigated the CIA, then that's just going to open the door up for all the Muslims to come in and attack this country. I mean, which is, I know, is so asinine to think that, but you know, all I had to do was just shake my head in disgust.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the this is one of the arguments that they're making. Oh, it's going to put us at risk. Oh, these people don't have pictures from Abu Ghraib that they all run around that they have taped to the walls of their bedrooms. I mean, it's not like it's not like this report is really saying anything that the world didn't know. What the report is saying is we're embarrassed by this. We're horrified by this. And that, I think, is a good thing. Cliff, thank you very much for that. George in Santee, California. Hey, George.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to your show yesterday and your suggestions about the pardon. I totally disagree with that.
Well, the pardon, hang on just a second. Be clear. The pardon is the second part of a two-part process. The first part of that process is identifying the crimes that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and their buddies committed. Putting it on the record for history, for all of history, for the next 100 or more years of American history, and then saying, and to avoid a long drawn out and inevitably fruitless process, legal process, I'm going to pardon you right now. But the first and most important part is the piece that's really, that's why you do that. George, back to you.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Tom, but you know, the reason why we're dealing with this today is because we haven't punished those crimes in the past. This torture thing is nothing new. It happens in every war. You know, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was there in Quang Tri in 68 and 69. In Vietnam, the CIA called it the Phoenix Program, and nobody got punished back then. And if nobody gets punished now, this stuff is just going to get kicked down the road for some future generation to have to deal with it.
Yeah. I don't disagree, and I think that prosecuting people within the CIA, particularly for things like destruction of evidence, I mean, it's so obvious. The problem is that the current director of the CIA was apparently, up to his eyeballs in this stuff, so which puts Obama in a really difficult position, having the Department of Justice prosecute the guy who's the sitting, head of the CIA. But why not identify? But the fact of the matter is that, I mean, we can go after the CIA on this, and I think that that's entirely reasonable and appropriate, but going after Bush and Cheney is going to be almost impossible because of the politics of it. How else would you do it without a pardon?
We have to keep pushing for that. We still have...
But we're pushing for what? What agency is going to prosecute them?
Well, those are good questions, but we can't back down because...
Back down from what?
Back down to these things. We're allowing those people that argue against the torture. You're throwing those people under the bus.
No, I understand what you're saying, George. What I'm saying is, if you consider identifying Bush's crimes, listing them, branding him with them, and then pardoning him for that as backing down, what are you backing down from, George?
Yes.
Yeah. What are you backing down? We got about 10 seconds. What are you backing down from?
Well, backing down from our desire to get rid of this stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm all in favor of reasserting our desire to get rid of it. I just, I don't see a process. Congress isn't going to do a prosecution. George, thank you for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. And just to close this loop. Whenever I hear a conservative say words to the effect of, by releasing this torture report, we are putting American lives at risk, my answer is no. By torturing people, we put American lives at risk. By releasing the torture report, we're actually reducing the risk to American lives because we're asserting to the world that we don't do that anymore, that that was an aberration. Here, Andrea Tantaros went off on a screed about this on Fox News yesterday, I believe it was. And here's a couple clips I'd like to essentially respond to. Here's the first one.
The United States of America is awesome. We are awesome. But we've had this discussion. We've closed the book on it and we've stopped doing it. And the reason they want to have this discussion is not to show how awesome we are. This administration wants to have this discussion to show us how we're not awesome.
Right. So the question, I think that we're incredibly awesome. I'm an unabashed American patriot, I would say. I believe in my country. I believe in the founding ideals of my country. I'm proud of my country in many ways. There are many things about this country that I'm embarrassed about, many things that I think we could do so much better. You know, our gun violence, for example, is, you know, not an example for the world. Our incarceration rates, not an example for the world. Our childhood poverty, not an example for the world. But on the other hand, the founding principles of this country continue to animate our conversations. In fact, they animate this conversation. And I'm curious, you know, what do you think America is awesome? It's easy for us to sit around and complain. But what are the things that actually make America awesome? Because, you know, I agree with the first half of what Andrea said. We're an awesome country, but, you know, it doesn't mean that we're number one at anything in particular other than incarceration. But, you know, it's a hell of a lot better place to live than a lot of places where I have lived and worked around the world. But the second one where she says, you know, they you know, we close the book on this. We don't need to have this conversation. No, we do need to have this conversation. And she's right. What she was trying to say was Democrats are releasing this report because the Republicans are going to take control of the Senate and they will never let it come out because it looks bad for Bush. And the Democrats don't care if it looks bad for Bush. In fact, that's kind of a bonus. Well, true. But is that the Democrats' fault? No, that's Bush's fault. Okay, here's the second clip from Andrew.
This administration is doing this because they're the same administration that goes on these apology tours, because they believe naively that if we can just shame ourselves and convince the world how horrible we are and put us on a moral equivalency with all these other countries, then maybe they will stop beheading Americans and putting our heads on sticks.
Now, that is one of the most stupid things I've ever heard. I don't know how to say it beyond that. I mean, just the fundamental logic. First of all, apology tours. There is no such thing. This is an entirely Fox News, you know, created meme. So just, you know, set that. This is the tragedy of siloed information. But beyond that, the idea that by apologizing for committing crimes, we are reducing ourselves to the level of a country that tortures or a group like ISIS that cuts people's heads off is, as I said, stupid. I mean, it's the exact opposite of reality. The person who stands up and says, yes, I did that and I'm sorry. Yes, I did that and I want to atone for it. Yes, I did that and I wanted to fix this. That person earns our respect. Even Republicans. I mean, David Vitter gets busted for sleeping with hookers here in Washington, D.C. And he stands up in front of the world with his wife by his side and says, yes, I did it, and I'm very sorry. He gets a standing ovation from his Republican colleagues when he comes back into the Senate, and he gets reelected by the citizens of Louisiana. We love people who acknowledge their errors and say anyway that they're going to change their ways. And the world does, too. This is a human nature characteristic. So to say that acknowledging our mistakes so that we can become a better nation somehow makes us a worse nation, that's unpatriotic. It's not just stupid. It's unpatriotic. It is fundamentally un-American. It is not how any patriot would behave, in my humble opinion. How any president historically, by and large, with the possible exception of Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan, has behaved. Although Reagan had an oops moment, right? When the barracks was blown up in Lebanon and over 200 Marines died. Reagan didn't say, I'm going to have a war on those terrorists. No, he just pulled everybody out of Lebanon. Case closed. Oops. Shouldn't have had him there. So learning from your mistakes is one of the things that makes America awesome. We started out with this mistake of Indian genocide and slavery. We learned from that mistake, and we've kind of cleaned up both. I mean, we're still working on both. We start out with the mistake of women being disenfranchised. We're cleaning that up. We have at various times in our history made the mistake of just turning the capitalists and the billionaires totally loose on America. The Gilded Age of the late 19th century, the 1920s, and the Reagan era to today. Hopefully we'll clean that up again. We've cleaned it up twice before.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And I continue to think that one of the best ways to establish that the Bush administration committed crimes is to identify them and then pardon them. Very pultaciously ugly, the good. The Sierra Club. That organization was one of a number of groups who helped organize a protest Monday outside the office of the United States Trade Representative. That protest was in opposition to the ongoing secret negotiations of the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA, also known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. If approved, the TPP, or SHAFTA, would create the biggest so-called free trade zone in history, would gut regulations, and would give private corporations dangerous new powers. Activists touched on all of these problems at Monday's protest. Let's hope the Obama administration is listening, because approving SHAFTA, the TPP, really would be a disaster both for the environment and the economy. Good on the Sierra Club for speaking out. The bad, Tammy Bruce. On Monday, the Fox so-called news contributor claimed that the Rolling Stone piece on rape at the University of Virginia was inaccurate because liberals are more interested in romanticizing rape victims than telling the truth. Seriously, check it out.
This is why investigative reporting is almost dead in this country, and why the damage that's done, almost a romanticizing of victimhood. You know, look, authentic feminists, we know violence against women happens. We want it to stop. But there has now been a movement over the last decade or so, like the War on Women meme, to romanticize being a victim, and I think that that's equally as
dangerous. I don't think anybody wants...
Yeah, right, because it's so cool to be a rape victim. What universe do these people live in? And by the way, investigative journalism in the United States is largely dead because of the corporatization of our media. We talked to Ronald Reagan about that in the Sherman Antitrust Act. And the very, very ugly Gordon Klingenschmitt. During a broadcast of his web program Monday, the newly elected member of the Colorado State Legislature mocked a lesbian couple in Texas for fighting a stay that preserves their state's ban on gay marriage. Because of that stay, one of the women will not have legal parenthood over her partner's still unborn child, something Klingenschmitt said would be a non-issue if the couple just avoided living in sin. Check it out.
Isn't it a tragedy when you can't have homosexual sin right away? That's what they're alleging, and of course, it's ridiculous. In God's government, that sin ought to be delayed indefinitely. And in fact, if they remained abstinent until death, maybe they wouldn't be punished for the sin that they're trying to expedite. Some people are in a hurry to run to hell.
I did mention that this guy was elected to serve in the Colorado legislature, right? That is very, very ugly. Okay, Paul in Houston, Texas. It says here, Paul, that you disagree with me, so you go to the top of the list. What is your argument for torturing people?
Well, these people, let me ask you this. Have you ever been in the military? Have you served over in Iraq, Afghanistan?
No. I have been in war zones, though. I was in Uganda during the Civil War in 1980.
Okay.
And I've been in Darfur and Somalia with, you know, guys with AK-47s following me around. I wasn't shot at there. I was shot at in Uganda. I have some familiarity with what a war zone is like, but no, I've never been in combat.
Okay. This is my perspective. I have. Okay, and these guys are going. Okay, we turned five of the worst out of Guantanamo Bay loose. Okay, if this information gets where we can kill the most wanted man in the world, I don't care what they did to him. If it saved American lives, yeah, it did.
No, it didn't.
It most certainly.
Read the Senate report. They came right out and said that there was no useful intelligence. And in fact, a lot of bad intelligence came out of this. We spent hundreds of millions of dollars running around the world trying to. In fact, we stopped a bunch of airplanes that were flying out of Europe because people told their torturers what the torturers wanted to hear. And it was total fantasy.
You know, these guys are jihadist terrorists. They put themselves in that position. Whatever happened to them, you know, hey, they're cutting people's heads off. They're killing hundreds of thousands of people, innocent people, other Muslims.
So you're saying,
okay,
Paul, that torture's
you're
saying that torture's just fine with you. If torture is so effective, Paul, hang on just a second here. If torture is effective, if you're right, the torture is something that's consistent with American values, and it's effective, and we don't give a rat's ass about somebody who's behaving badly, then should we start doing torture in the United States? Should we torture, for example, before people are brought to trial? Should we torture them when we interrogate them?
We're not talking about Americans. We're talking about
we are
people on a combat battlefield.
We are talking about what America does.
That are combatants.
Right, but we're talking about what America does. But if torture works on the battlefield, wouldn't it work in Houston, Texas? Shouldn't you, Paul, if your next door neighbor accuses you of smoking dope in your backyard or molesting their kid or something? I mean, shouldn't you be taken down to the police department, strapped to a board, flipped upside down, and have water poured all over your face?
You know, just like a liberal, you're putting this is totally. We're not talking.
It's a serious question, Paul. If we are a nation who tortures, where does it stop?
I'd like to know where the importance of turning this information loose, where it really falls. And you said it's all political. It's political. I don't really care. I'm not for one side or the other politically. I don't really care. Okay.
I suspect you do. Most of us do.
No, you're totally wrong.
So you don't care if the president is George Bush or Al Gore. It doesn't matter to you.
No. When I was being deployed, I met George Bush at Fort Polk, Louisiana.
Right.
And I didn't want to go. They told you had to go. And, you know, to be honest.
To go where?
My family knows.
To go off to your military service, you mean?
No. To go see George Bush when he flew into Fort Polk.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You were forced to go to the airfield.
Yeah, because you were military, you were going to be one of the props for his photo op.
Pretty much. And to be honest, I shook his hand, told him I wouldn't vote for him because I joined the military. I knew what I was getting into, but did that mean I wanted to go? No.
Right.
Okay, yada yada. That's a whole other story.
No, I understand, and I respect and salute you for serving your country. That said. And I get it. There are bad guys out there. And when you're at war with bad guys, you kill them. But when you take them prisoner, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Dwight Eisenhower, all of these guys during times of war, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War II, all three of them said, treat our prisoners of war with respect. And what was the consequence of that? The consequence of that was that British soldiers and Hessian mercenaries in the Revolutionary War, by the thousands, surrendered to American forces because they knew they would be treated well and they didn't want to fight or die in the Revolutionary War. In the Civil War, Confederate soldiers in huge numbers surrendered to Union forces because they knew that they wouldn't be tortured, whereas the Confederate prisons were actually torturing Union soldiers. In Germany, the Germans tortured American prisoners of war. In fact, they murdered 10,000 of them. But we treated German prisoners well. So what happened as we invaded, as Eisenhower was leading the troops into Germany, German soldiers were running up to Americans going, I surrender. Please, put me in your jail and feed me. I mean, there are good practical reasons to do what George Washington ordered his troops to do.
Okay, let me ask you, when we first invaded Iraq, we took prisoners, no problem, correct?
Yeah.
We're not taking military personnel at this point. We're taking average Joe Blow that's got an AK-47 that's a jihadist, or it's got an RPG, and their sole goal is to destroy anybody that doesn't believe what they believe.
Right.
It's a fine line, granted.
No, but you're right on that, Paul. You're right. But does that mean that we go into the Middle East? I mean, Saudi Arabia beheads people every Friday in Riyadh in the public stadium, right? That's who they are. Do we go in and say, here we are, the United States. We're going to tell you how to live. We're the example for you to live by. We torture people.
No. See, here's my thing, man. You got a picture with a guy with five severed heads that he's kneeling by.
Right.
Okay, do you really have sympathy for him? You know what I'm saying?
I have no sympathy for him at all. I want him either killed on the battlefield or arrested and spending the rest of his life in prison. I want him to be appropriately punished. But to say that we are the United States, we're the guys who torture, that's not what you signed up for when you joined the military, is it?
Me? No. Me personally, I would not. You know, I would have a problem with somebody if I saw somebody tasering a terrorist like every 5 minutes. I wouldn't say nothing to him. Would I personally pull the trigger? I guess it'd be the same. But yeah, if this guy just came out the battlefield and he was a high-value target, I'd say get the information you can get from him, because after dealing with these people on the battlefield, they're really cowards, and it doesn't really take much for them to break.
And that's the point, Paul. The way that we got the information from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed that laid out the entire 9/11 plot, because he put the thing together, the way we got that was by an FBI agent bringing the guy a sandwich and sitting and talking with him for several days, talking with him about his religion, talking with him about his family, getting to know him, developing rapport with him, and we got everything from him. This is how we got the information that led to bin Laden. Once we started torturing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he shut up. Once we started torturing Abu Zubaydah, he shut up. Several of these guys, when we tortured them, they gave us phony information that cost us American lives and cost us American treasure. Torture is not the way to go. Paul, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is a matter of practical reality. Obviously there's a moral issue here, but there's also a practical issue. Torture doesn't work. Welcome back. Susan in Brunswick, Georgia. Hey, Susan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom, I have a couple of points that I would like to address the audience. First of all, I absolutely agree 100% with what you're saying, and here's my reason why. Yes, George Bush and Cheney, they should be hung, but the reality is...
I don't think they should be hung, Susan. Let's not go there, please.
Okay.
They should be tried.
Tried. But the reality is that nobody's going to find them guilty. Nobody's going to bring them to trial. And even if you did take them to trial, there is a chance that they could be found innocent, number one.
Right.
And then the second thing is when you pardon somebody, it really is a sense of an admission of guilt as well. And then when you go down into the history books 5-10 years from now, just like Nixon, their name is totally ruined. It's out in the open as to what they did. There's no question about what they did. And in a sense, by pardoning them, they are actually found guilty of what they've done. And just as an example with Nixon, with what we found out now, what he has done, you can't find anybody that can actually say, yeah, I voted for Nixon and I supported Nixon and everything that
right.
he did.
And Nixon never confessed to his crimes. But everybody knows what his crimes were because Gerry Ford pardoned him.
Exactly. And I think that, and I think the other important issue that people don't understand either is that when you torture people like this, like you said, you're not getting the proper information, but when you torture people, it means that when these people get an American soldier or they pick an American tourist off the streets of Europe, that they're going to be tortured like that as well. And that's the number one reason why you don't want to torture people, because they will do it back to us. And I think anybody, even somebody who says that they were in the military, I think if they, people that agree with what went on, I think that they voted for George Bush and they can't come to terms that they voted for somebody that's as maniacal as this person is. And
well,
that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, and there's a there's a very good piece of logic to what you're saying there, Susan, and that is that by asserting that torture of prisoners of war is an appropriate thing to do, we are condemning all of our soldiers to be tortured if they get arrested on the battlefield. And now the other side would say, oh, well, they're going to torture our soldiers anyway. Maybe. But, not every country is going to do that. And if we say that this is the way it should be, then very quickly every country is going to do that. And bang, we're back in the 15th century.
And that's why you see these people beheading other people. It's because of what we have done. And that's why you don't torture. Thank you, Tom. You do a great job.
Yeah. Thank you, Susan. Thank you for the call. Well said. And I guess this is starting to kind of gel, to clarify. And the only problem, of course, is that you got a bunch of people at the CIA who are trying to CYA, who are trying to cover their butts. And maybe they should rename it the CYA. It's not the Central Intelligence Agency. It's the Cover Your Butt Agency. Okay. Anyway, it's... we'll continue the conversation right now. This is 10 minutes before. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi. Well, I always call and talk about the arrests here on the corrupt governor and corrupt government, but I'd like to tell you some good stuff. When you asked about what's good about America,
mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've learned these last 3 years is how amazing it is with the federal budget and with nonprofits, how much they do with so little and how much the citizens do grassroots. And I'd like to tell you about a couple of things that have happened here.
Mm-hmm.
One is called Santas Without Chimneys. There's a woman who works for the city driving truck, snow plows, and et cetera. And she's known hard times, and she's known what it's like to be homeless. And she realized that children who had no home and children whose parents were working and couldn't go get toys for them or get on the list were being missed. So 3 years ago, they started doing that for the kids. This is our third year, and it's amazing how many children they're helping. Some of the presents have to be delivered at school because the kids don't know where they'll be on Christmas. Right. And some families are couch surfing, so they're able to deliver them to homes.
Yeah.
And it's santaswithoutchimneys.org if people would like to donate.
Sweet.
And then also we have Stone Soup Squad, again, started by the same woman and picked up by the core activists and then other people in the community, that goes out twice a week at night and feeds people who can't get into the shelters, who won't go, who are mentally ill, who have post-stress from the war, and brings them food and survival gear.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Ohm Build, which is building tiny houses.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out of Occupy Madison. Really, our occupying the Capitol was the original Occupy. And these are a group of people who have fought for the last year. They're building with the homeless and for them, meaning that you have to do it like Habitat for Humanity. And,
right.
And we have a little village now.
So it's absolutely marvelous stuff. Catherine, I would add, Free Speech TV, Pacifica Radio, the Hunter School, hunterschool.org. These are charities that I'm involved with and are nonprofits. And I'm continually amazed by how much gets done with how little money. You're right. You're absolutely right. Thank you for calling and sharing that. Mike in Schererville, Indiana. Am I saying that right, Mike? Mike?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, listening to Sirius.
Well, I'm in Florida. I'm just going across Florida. But
oh, okay.
I just want to make a couple of comments on, they talk about this torture. Now, if I can remember back when Jessica Lynch was captured in the Kuwait War, when the United States and all these people on Fox News up at arm because she was supposed to have been tortured and mistreated over there and all that, but it turned out to be a lie.
Right.
The hospital she was in that was actually helping her. And all the, but they were against that, the torture when they were doing that supposedly to one of our soldiers.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. The Jessica Lynch case is a great example of this. And no, the Iraqis were not torturing her; they were saving her life. But, you know, that was the meme that was portrayed on American media by the Bush administration, is that we've got to stop, you know, the torture of this woman. And I think it was a fair amount of projection. They torture people, so they assume other people torture people. Mike, thank you for the call. Very well said. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. It says you want to disagree with me, Bob. What's up?
Hey, I so much enjoy your intelligence in the conversation, but I just have to disagree with the lens by which you're looking at things and discussing things. I don't share your point of view on the legitimacy of authority in the state today. I learned when I was in high school and in college, and then since, I still read all the time, listen to all these discussions. Authority is power grounded in reason. We've abandoned reason. We, as a society, with this government as our representative, abandoned reason years ago. And this is, we're trying to keep democracy intact.
Bob, we're dueling in abstractions. Give me an example of what you're talking about. I don't know what you mean.
Give you an example of what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Well, they're lying, okay? The people in power lie all the time.
Right.
And the military-industrial congressional complex that employs so many people, it's all a big convoluted trap.
And
it's
therefore, you would do what about it, Bob?
It's about corporate fascism.
Bob, therefore, you would do what about it?
Not being honest with us. We don't have any representation.
Bob, hang on just a second. Bob, therefore, you would do what about it?
Oh, I'm doing what I do. I talk to people. I write. I appeal to people.
You would complain about it.
More and more indifference.
What is the call for action? What should
candid discussion that anybody wants to have about the issues that we face in the time we live in? Because it's all been hijacked.
Okay, I'm not sure that we disagree. I mean, I for a long time I've been talking about how corrupted our conversation is in this country, both by our media and by a government that has been taken over by billionaires and corporations, by and large. I don't disagree with that, but I think that sitting around and complaining about it is not the thing to do. I think that getting active and doing something about it, and there's a lot that can be done about it. You know, MoveToAmend.org is doing spectacular work. They've gotten over 500 communities now, over 20 states that have passed resolutions.
Hey, Tom, are you still there?
I am. Can you hear me, Bob?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Are you not paying attention to what I'm saying?
I thought I was responding to what you said.
Our lives. People are being thrown in prison. People are being destroyed by people in power. This is not a legitimate authority.
So therefore what? Therefore,
well,
you...
We're going to have to organize from the ground up. We don't use our politicians. They use us. We've got to get that straight in our heads. They follow the parades that we create. So if we're going to talk about what we want to talk about, we have to be allowed to talk about it by people like you who are on the air. We can't just censor the conversation all the time based on the political situation. We have to deal with the physical situation of survival on the planet and quit ignoring this for the sake of the next election.
Okay, Bob, I thank you for your call and your comments. I still don't see where our fundamental disagreement is. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour. Matthew Heimbach is going to be with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case about whether the, this is in Texas, whether Texas officials should have Lawrence Hurley writing for, I believe it's for Reuters, whether Texas officials should have approved a specialty license plate that displays the Confederate flag. The Sons of Confederate Veterans are saying that this is their free speech right to have a Confederate flag on their license plate, that Confederate soldiers are among their ancestors and they're simply celebrating their ancestry. On the other hand, there's a fairly substantial number of people, particularly people of color, who are suggesting that the Confederate flag, or at least the Confederate battle flag, which is the one that's typically used, the stars and bars, are the symbols of the Klan and of hate crimes. So Matthew Heimbach is back with us. He's the president of the Traditionalist Youth Network, a member of the League of the South. He's a former member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and he founded the White Student Union while at Towson University. Trad Youth, as in traditional, tradyouth.org is his website. Matthew, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Tom.
So, you know, As a white guy who loves the Confederate flag, I guess, how do you not get that the Confederate flag to a lot of people means hate?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I think the biggest issue here is if just because people are offended by someone's identity and the symbols that matter to them, I don't think that should be a reason that we shouldn't be allowed to show those symbols. Here in the great state of Indiana where I live, we have the Indiana Black Expo where it's essentially where, blacks are able to display their pride in their culture. And some people might have a problem, not necessarily with black culture, but the idea of identity politics. But it doesn't really matter. It's the fact that people should be allowed to honor their ancestors, honor the symbols that matter to them. And just because people are offended, that doesn't give a right that we should be able to silence free speech.
But part of the black heritage, part of the black identity is not that they committed genocide on white people, whereas part of the white heritage, and particularly the Confederate heritage, is that they did commit genocide on black people. Are you suggesting that if somebody has an ancestor who was a Nazi, that they should have a swastika on their car?
Well, Tom, the thing is, if you look, there are Native American plates, and before the white man ever came to North America, Indian tribes were killing one another, enslaving one another. The Lakota and the Pawnee enslaved one another all the time. In terms of the black slaves who came here, that it was generally blacks in Africa who enslaved other blacks through warfare. And
Matthew, you're doing a marvelous job of blaming the victims here, but you're factually wrong.
No, it's
the fact of the matter is that, yes, there,
no,
hang on just a second here. I can't let this stand. I've written books on anthropology, particularly the history of the Native Americans. Yes, there were times of conflict among Native American tribes, and yes, some of them were quite substantial. And typically they were caused by climate change, oddly enough, you know, pushing people from one territory into another. But by and large, most tribes lived in peace with each other because nobody wanted somebody else's land. They didn't want their ghosts. I mean, you know, look it up. The slave traders in Africa, yeah, but they weren't, they wouldn't have been selling the slaves if white people from Europe hadn't gone and said, hey, let me give you some money to capture some people. You can't blame the victims. You have to own up to the fact that slavery happened in the United States for hundreds of years. It was a cruel and vicious practice. It's inconsistent with human values. It's inconsistent with American values. And celebrating slavery in any way or trying to make excuses for it by saying, well, you know, Indians and black people did it too, is just as wrong as celebrating it in the first place.
Now, Tom, I'm not here to defend slavery. But I guarantee
you. But that's what you just tried to do.
No. But the thing is, if you look, being locked into an economic situation that's wrong does not mean you must demonize the entire group of people. I guarantee the majority of your listeners, myself and you included, have clothes on our back right now that are made in sweatshops in China or places in Southeast Asia. That is a little better than slavery, the treatment those people are dealt with. But simply because we are part of the capitalist system does not mean that we have to forever be carrying around baggage and feeling guilty about what our ancestors did. Now, I'm not supporting slavery, but I will not hate my ancestors and the symbols that they sacrificed their lives for simply because it offends other people. Every group of people has a right to an identity, a right to their own symbols, and a right to exist, and that's all I'm fighting for. And the Confederacy,
so if,
love it or hate it, is my people and our symbols.
I got that. So to my question, if I had ancestors who had fought in Hitler's army, and I was proud of them, maybe not proud of what they did. I'm guessing you're not proud of your ancestors owning slaves or the way they treated their slaves, but you know, hey, they're your ancestors. You know, we all have to deal with the baggage of our past. Do you think that somebody who had a Nazi soldier should proudly display a swastika on their car?
I think everybody has the right to be able to support their own identity and their own history. I mean, you look here in America, the persecution of Palestinians by Israel. No one would want to take away the Jews' right to be able to have pride in their own people. But I think all of us can agree the apartheid regime in Israel is against all human rights, using the weapons they use against innocent civilians, bombing housing complexes and hospitals. That's horrendous. But no one wants to stop Jews from being able to have their own identity.
You're throwing up a straw man and changing the subject. We're talking about the Confederate. We're talking about slavery in the United States.
Yeah, we're talking about identity, that every group of people on this planet, every ethnic group, has a right to their own identity, and we shouldn't have to apologize for it.
So you're suggesting that the identity of people, of white people with ancestors from the South, such as yourself, that that identity is so bound up in slavery that the only symbol that you can think of to proudly proclaim your heritage is the battle flag of the Confederate Army, which was fighting a war explicitly and specifically to preserve slavery.
No, we have a lot of different symbols. We have a lot of different cultural customs that we all participate in. But most importantly, it comes down to not that the Confederate battle flag is the only symbol for us. It's that I think Southerners, we just refuse to apologize because we don't need to. It's our symbol. It's our identity. No other group of people.
So your identity that you're proud of is that your ancestors owned and presumably beat and raped and murdered slaves. That's what you're proud of. That's your identity.
You know, the reason I love my family is not because of any of their attributes, whether they're tall, short, smart, stupid, doesn't matter. There are plenty of horrible warts on the face of every group of people's ancestors, their history. But I refuse to turn my back on my own family. And that's what you're
right. You know, I understand that, Matthew. And I think that that's a totally human impulse and probably at some level a noble one. I'm just asking, can't you find a symbol which is not the in-your-face to black people symbol of the stars and bars? Can't you find another symbol as the one to demonstrate your Southern Confederate States of America heritage?
The Confederate battle flag has over 300,000 martyrs of Southern men who gave life and limb to fight for it.
To preserve slavery.
Whether they believed in slavery or not, that they saw defending their homes and their families.
Jefferson Davis said that they were fighting a war to preserve slavery. This is not a matter of dispute.
And you know what? The Union Army, that I think it was horrendous, the fact that you've got white men on both sides, many of whom were Christians, killing each other, where at the end of the day, capitalists and bankers and corrupt politicians are the ones who end up winning.
But what does that have to do with your wanting to have a symbol that says to black people that you're proud that your ancestors enslaved them on your car?
I am proud that my ancestors were willing to stand on their own 2 feet against horrendous odds.
But don't you get it that a black person will look at your car and say he's proud of being of having slaveholders in his family?
I should never have to apologize for my ancestors and my identity, Tom.
Okay. Matthew Heimbach, president of the Traditionalist Youth Network and a member of the League of the South. His website, TradYouth, TradYouth.org. Matthew, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, Germany has actually banned the swastika. If you show up in Germany with a swastika, you go to jail. Should we do something like that with the Confederate flag here or not? Yeah, that's true. That's a larger issue. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Sandra, watching Free Speech TV in Colorado Springs. Hey, Sandra, you wanted to get back to torture. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, by the way.
Yes, thank you so much, Tom. I've just gotten out of the hospital, and so my memory, I can't pull all of these names out of history. But I want to touch upon just a few points, and then I'm going to let you take it from there.
Okay.
Do you remember back, you know, Bush keeps saying, well, the legal people told me it was legal to torture.
Right.
And remember the attorney general, I can't think of his name, but he was in the hospital.
John Ashcroft.
Exactly. Oh, you're wonderful.
Well, actually, Shane is wonderful. He came up with it. But yeah.
Well, I mean, but he didn't agree. He told them he didn't agree with what they were doing.
Right.
And they were trying to make him sign those papers.
Right.
Now, the reason why I bring that up is because, and also I want to give credit to Susan from, I think, Georgia. Mm-hmm. The only problem I have with what she said was, she keeps using the past tense, and my computer's not working today, and I can't read this because I wanted to spend the day reading this whole 500 or 600 page document. But we have authors like Naomi Klein, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, and he even addressed it yesterday. I think it was out on RT or Al Jazeera. This isn't all was in the past. This is going on now. And if we look, and you ask Bob for an example, I'm going to give you one. It's Benghazi. Both the Democrats and the Republicans are lying to us about what happened at Benghazi. And if we look at that situation with open eyes, we will see all around the world. Jeremy Scahill has gone there, saw it, wrote books about it, but the American people either don't read them or they don't want to believe their lying eyes.
Right.
These black sites, and, you know, they're trying to say, well, it occurred on...
So you're saying Benghazi was one of the CIA black sites that were used for torture?
I believe it is. Because if you read what happened, first of all, they killed the ambassador. The ambassador doesn't stay at the consulate. He stays at the embassy.
Right.
And if you go back and you read the news reports from around the world, you will see that he just happened to be there that night.
Right.
But those people, there were two attacks that night. The first one is when they set the place on fire. They didn't kill him. I've asked people, I'm like Bob, I asked people, what happened to him? Everybody thinks somebody shot him. He didn't get shot. What happened to him was he died of smoke inhalation. And the reason why he was there, because he happened to be at the embassy that night. It was late before he could start back to the embassy in another city.
Right, he was at the consulate.
He decided to stay there, so he thought he would be safe.
Right.
They stormed the embassy. They couldn't find these prisoners all around the world, all over Africa. Jeremy Scahill has written about it. The CIA has these interrogation centers, a.k.a. black sites.
So you're suggesting that the reason why the Benghazi consulate was attacked was because the attackers thought that they would be able to liberate people who were being tortured by America.
They were trying to get to those people, and this
That's
is going
fascinating.
On right now.
That makes a lot of sense. Sandra, we're out of time, but thank you for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We can, you know, feel free to weigh in on whether the Confederate flag is offensive to you and what it means in the United States and what's going on. But I think that, you know, a lot of people still want to talk about this torture thing that came out yesterday, and it is very, very concerning. By the way, the other thing that you need to note is that right now Republicans are you know, they're moving legislation through to keep the government open. And there's a bunch of really nasty stuff in that legislation. There's further deregulation of Wall Street. There's further deregulation of the amount of money rich people can give to political parties. It's tripling. So you can give a couple $100,000 now to the parties individually. You add that to McCutcheon, and it's just huge. You know, say that again? Tenfold. Okay, Shano says it's a tenfold increase, $30,000 to $300,000. They're putting in an amendment to prevent Washington, D.C. from going forward with legalizing marijuana. We were going to have pot stores in Washington, D.C. in a few months. No, Congress says, no, you can't do that. That, I believe, is the handiwork of, what is it, Andy Miller, the Republican congressman from Maryland who constantly is trying to run Washington, D.C. This is, you know, frankly, a violation of the 1973-74 Home Rule Act, which Congress passed, which says that Congress, even though it has authority over the District of Columbia, it should exercise that authority only in extreme situations. And I don't think, you know, decriminalizing pot is an extreme situation. It's happened in two of our states so far, and, you know, the Republic hasn't fallen. Andy Harris, thank you. Andy Harris is the guy. You know, if you're thinking of calling a congressman and saying, would you please pull that out of that legislation, that would be the guy, Andy Harris. Congress's switchboard is 202-225-3121, by the way. There's a thing to let J.P. Morgan Chase, this from the Campaign for America's Future's Progressive Breakfast email. A deal was announced late yesterday after Democrats accepted Republican demands to undo banking regulations. Have you noticed? I mean, you know, the Democrats are accepting the Republican demands, but it's the Republicans who are demanding this. The Republicans want, you know, less banking regulations, less fracking regulations. They don't care if your checking account goes to hell. As long as the billionaires who fund the Republican Party are in good shape, they're fine. They don't care if, the, you know, there's poison wafting over your neighborhood because, you know, the Republicans and the billionaires, they live in neighborhoods where there isn't any poison. It's breathtaking. How is it that Americans don't figure out what the Republican Party is all about? What all these Fox News commentators and all these right-wing talk show hosts are all about? Being shills for corporations and billionaires. That's their agenda. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, they're going to allow underfunded multi-employer pension plans to cut benefits. So if you're thinking of retiring with a pension, you might want to talk to John Klein, a Minnesota Republican, who is basically writing pension cuts into this budget. And Democrat George Miller, a California Democrat, is going along with it. So anyhow, it goes on. The Elizabeth Warren's last Wall Street attack was her boldest yet, says TNR's Harry Reid. Well, anyhow, don't not go through the whole thing. Steve in Ramona, California. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Thank you for what you do every day. Sunshine is best expected, and just getting this information out is so important.
Thank you.
I served in the military. And I served over in Iraq. My last job, I was flying helicopters. So we had a bunch of missions. But one of our missions is we'd pick up people from the battlefield and we'd transport them. Among other things, to Abu Ghraib and black sites.
Wow.
I'm pretty upset about the information here because we all suspected this stuff was going on. I'm actually a little bit shocked at the degree that was going on because it flies in the face of everything that I was ever taught as a soldier with my professional ethos as a soldier. And I've got some real problems with it because it removed my ability to say, I will not follow this order. And that was done with secrecy. And while I understand that I don't need to know everything that's going on, if I had any idea that the extent of this torture was so bad, I would have probably made a stand.
You would have refused to fly the prisoners to the black sites.
Oh, absolutely. I know I did. And for me, it's just as this hits the sunshine and I have to realize that, it's just another thing to keep me up at night.
Wow.
But and I'll put it in its place. But I almost feel like we totally lost control. And at this point, as a nation, we are facing our faults and having a catharsis because we've been out of control.
Yes.
It's sad for me because my whole career as a soldier, I held certain tenets. I came in and I tried to foster my ethics, and I tried to keep a good, solid, moral, ethical background. And sometimes, particularly on battlefields, it's very difficult. But if you can, you can be that bright, shining light, that American soldier that people see as hope.
Right.
But when you undermine that, it's just tragic.
Yeah.
And it was unnecessary.
It really and truly is. The U.S. soldiers, the liberating soldiers, were viewed as heroes in Europe in 1945. And
yeah, we were told that early in the training, Tom. I'm sorry, but I was told that early in my career. Those citing that the Germans surrendered to us instead of the Russians because they knew that we were safe.
Right. Yeah, and the Russians were not treating their prisoners as well as the United States was. In fact, in many cases, they were treating them quite poorly.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot of veterans calling in today and using the word patriot as they justify terror. Nothing they were ever taught in the military would have supported the actions that I'm afraid we took as a nation. And I have a little problem with that because I want to say to them, you weren't paying attention.
Yeah, well said. Steve, thank you for your service to your country, and thank you for a very, very thoughtful and heartfelt statement on our program. I appreciate it. I appreciate your listening to the program. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls. Hey, I just got an email from Don Siegelman. If you have not gone over to free-don.org and signed up, I strongly encourage you to. Former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman is preparing to leave Oakdale Prison for a hearing in Montgomery, Alabama on the 15th, where today is the 10th. He doesn't know yet. Is he going to be flown there? Is it going to be a multi-hour ride in a car? He is apparently going to be shackled. He says, it's the night before I leave on the magical Con Air mystery tour ending in Montgomery on the 15th. I am both uptight because of the expectations of handcuffs, shackles, and chains, the uncomfortable bus and plane, and stuffed because my homeboy, Sonny Breckenridge from Alabama, and a few others conjured up a delicious bowl of layered corn chips, chopped vegetables, cilantro, green bell peppers, and jalapeno peppers and tomatoes, topped with beans, more chips, hot melted cheese, more corn chips, beef and sour cream, and more veggies. He tells me of the inmate Steve, who gave him a handwritten note, which he's sending to his son Joseph. The note says, when I see you, I think back to meeting your son, and I wish he could see how you have carried yourself in here in prison, despite all you have faced, and from how you have inspired not only myself but others here. I know your family would always be proud of your actions. Thank you for being an encouraging light and always keeping things upbeat with a smile. It's made all the difference, your friend Steve. So anyhow, Don Siegelman, there's a chance on the 15th. He's got this hearing coming up. So get over to free-don.org and find out what's going on with America's political prisoner here. It's pretty astounding. In fact, it's extremely astounding. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, you know, after listening to your caller, Paul, and your guest, Matthew, it is so cute when evil evangelical hypocrites do exactly the opposite of what Jesus Christ would do. It's hilarious. I mean, you have one guy that's pretty much defending the indefensible slavery in this country, and you have another guy defending torture in our country, and it's okay if you do it to certain people. And he was totally missing the point that you was bringing up. He was saying, you know, well, they weren't, you know, soldiers per se; they were combatants against us. And you told him during our first war here in America that combatants, not British soldiers, but mercenaries, were turning themselves over too. So I guess we were supposed to torture them and not the British soldiers.
Right.
He was totally missing the point.
Yeah, I know.
We don't do that. We shouldn't do that. If we want to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, we should hold ourselves to higher standards. Whether that be, no, we're not going to have a traitor's flag. And for me, as a black person in America, that's what I see first and foremost. As an American, I see a traitor's flag when I see the Confederate flag. You don't see people riding around with Al-Qaeda flags, you know? I mean, seriously, though, you don't see people riding around with Osama bin Laden face on a flag saying, this is our heritage. It's totally unacceptable as an American. As an American, there's no way in the world. And they kill me with this fake religion, this fake Christianity that they uphold, and this fake patriotism that they uphold, but they want to run around with the flag of the enemy. And what you started out with the program, Tom, was talking about they're trying to restore George W. Bush's legacy.
Yeah. And at the same time, destroy Obama's, by the way.
Absolutely. You can't do it. We live in a different world. We live in a world. Can you imagine if we live in a YouTube-type world that everyone could, well, put it like this right here. When after Ronald Reagan was out of office, if we live in a YouTube world, they couldn't have rewrote his history the way they done.
Right.
They can't do it with George W. Bush. The very first thing that people think of when they think of George W. Bush is either the Iraq War, torture, or the financial collapse. So that's Hoover, that's Nixon, and Lyndon Johnson rolled in one.
Hmm.
I mean, you can't erase something like that.
Well, they're trying.
I hate the fact that they voted for this guy twice, but it's hard to do something. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, no, they're trying. And by the way, you know, we didn't vote for George W. Bush twice. The first time, Al Gore won by 500,000 votes. And in fact, he actually won in Florida. It took a year for the ballot to be counted by the New York Times. And they acknowledged it in September or in November of 2001 in an article that was on the 17th page, as I recall, of the New York Times. They buried it because it was right after 9/11 and they didn't want to diminish George Bush's credibility as president by pointing out that he was actually not the elected president. The ballots in Florida actually went for Al Gore when they actually counted them. But, you know, no, we didn't vote for George W. Bush, at least not the first time.
You know what, Tom? Eventually, George W. Bush's presidency is going to become a reverse Woodstock. You know how if you ask a million people, were they at Woodstock, and they say, yeah, I was there at Woodstock, and people saying, and when they know very well that they wasn't there, you're going to have all these people say, I didn't vote for George W. Bush, when you know very well that they did.
You're right, Carl. You are absolutely
right. I'm going to leave it at that, man. You have a good day.
Thank you, Carl. Great to hear from you. Mary in Early, Iowa. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Well, I'm a little discouraged. I listened to, well, I didn't get in on the first of it, this conference, Josh Earnest. And it doesn't sound as if Obama is going to do anything. He is still, supporting Brennan for the CIA and the FBI head. And it doesn't sound, we have to do something. We have to do something. Then I turned it over to Fox News, and it was Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. And I
still?
Was very interested in, I beg your pardon?
They're still doing Benghazi? I mean, the Republicans issued a House report saying there's no there there.
A little while, and they were Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. But I was very interested in this lady's comment about all these black sites, these secret black sites. We have to change our ways. Our country is being devastated, and we're not respected in the world. It's hard for me to respect us.
And, well, you know, I think that when you admit your mistakes and you atone for them, I mean, admitting them is a huge thing to begin with, which we just did yesterday. And then and cleaning it up, you know, and we've done a lot of that, not all of it. I think that actually raises your status in the world.
Yes.
I think when these people say this is making America look bad in the eyes of the world, what they're really saying is this is making Lord George W. Bush and his administration look bad in the eyes of the world. And that's true, and it's appropriate.
Saying It's not that I don't love my country, but I'm afraid for it. Mm. I'm afraid for what's going on now. And, you know, if I were to come out and say mention Franklin Delano Roosevelt and what he had done during the Depression, people would not believe me or would laugh. But I listened to Ralph Nader, and it had an upper left-hand corner, 2012, and Ralph Nader was saying that they were being forbidden to talk about Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Washington, D.C., you know, I imagine the Republicans. Uh-huh. We know how to get out of this.
You're absolutely right. Mary, I've got to move along, but you are absolutely right. Thank you for the call. Donald in Oak Park, Illinois. You're on the air, Donald.
Yes, hi. How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine.
You know, real quickly, the one gentleman with the Confederate flag, as far as I'm concerned, well, sure, there's a lot of people. I see flags. I see Mexicans raising their flags. I see the Italians raising their flags. I'm Italian, but I have no use for Christopher Columbus. He was nothing but a terrible person. I'll fess up to it. But the thing is, with the Confederate flag, I think now that they use that flag to form a statement. It's a coded message saying we hate blacks and we hate people of color, and that's why I think they want that flag up. That's what that flag represents with them.
It's what it represents to me.
I'm sorry?
It's what it represents to me. I think it's what it represents to a lot of people, and that's why if I was the descendant of soldiers from the Confederate Army, and who knows, I may well be. I mean, my mother's family's been in this country since the late 1600s. And I know that we had some relatives in Kentucky, and in fact, we found my mother called me up one day. This was 30 years ago, just horrified. She was doing this genealogy thing, and she said, "Oh my God, one of our relatives was a slaveholder," and she had found that this guy every month he bought a slave, and it took her almost a year to track it all down. She had to go to Kentucky and go through all these genealogy records. Turned out what he was doing was he was buying slaves and freeing them. So she, you know, but on the other hand, James Madison is one of my relatives, and he was clearly a slave owner. So, I mean, you know, that doesn't mean that I'm going to say, hey, I'm proud of that part of my ancestry. I'm embarrassed by it.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
A couple of days ago, you mentioned about this individual that read, you read it on the air, that is, this one particular person in 1944 or 1945, he said where the country was going to go after the war.
Oh, yeah, it was Henry Wallace.
Henry Wallace. Where can I get that?
Google Henry Wallace, Tom Hartman, and fascism, and it should pop right up with any search engine. Donald, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, say what? Oh, yeah, it's on our website at TomHartman.com, the article. But you're still probably going to have to search for it. Although there's a search function on our website. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Frank, watching Free Speech TV in Portland, Maine. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. How about you?
Thank you. Doing well. I'm an American. I'm an American citizen, but I'm also a Native American.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the Three Fires. That is Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Ottawa. And, you know, we believe that, you know, the broken spiritual protocol that had occurred at the genocide of the Native Americans, as you stated, needs to be atoned. You know, that needs to be admitted and atoned so that the institutional racism that's so prevalent in America today, including the derivation of policies that are basically based in racism, nothing will change. You know, America is spiritually broken. It is a pluralistic country now. But the people in power, I mean, they're just out of hand, you know. And the idea that, you know, that now we see the CIA report, as Rachel Maddow pointed out last night, we all knew what they were doing. And I think it's a bad premise for the leaders of this country to do what they're doing, especially when the world is watching us. They're watching what we're doing with this principle of freedom that the Constitution has given to us that we all know. I walk with it in my back pocket. I know what it says. And, you know, as an example of what I'm doing in my life to confront norms, which is what I believe this is. It's norms out of hand. Nobody wants to say anything. My wife, whom I met 6 years ago, she fell when she was three, and she suffers from Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And 19 years ago, they found a medication that she doesn't have grand mal seizures anymore. But she does walk with leg braces, and she pushes a wheelchair. She wears two hearing aids. She's handicapped. Mm-hmm. And they as well suffer from people abusing them and maligning them in public.
Right.
And I was married to her, and we have a wonderful little life, and she came home on the verge of tears one day, and I said to her, you know, what's the matter? And she's a peacekeeper, so she didn't want to elaborate too much on it, but I finally got out of her. Here she was being abused by a group of women, and I just had enough. And one day we were in town, and she said that we went into a place to get our bus pass, and she said, four of those women that do this to me, they're in here. And I very eloquently but sternly stood up and announced that this is my wife. She's not going to be abused anymore.
Hmm.
I love her, and we have a five-year-old daughter. I said, if this doesn't stop, then, you know, you're going to have to answer to me.
Wow.
And it took a lot of courage on my part to stand up and say that, because all my life I gave in and I didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so my wife now is extremely happy because she's able to go around town and have a quality of life that really is second to none. She's happily married. We have a five-year-old daughter.
Because her husband stood up and spoke truth.
That's right. And I believe that is action as individuals we can take in our neighborhoods and our communities and our cities and our towns and hold our leaders, the politicians, responsible so that we don't have a culmination where we have a country where we just get so tired of being lied to all the time. I don't want to be a liar. I don't want my children to be a liar. I don't want the leaders of my country that I love to be liars.
Mm.
You know, somebody has to do the right thing. We know, regardless of religion, we know we all have innately a moral compass. And that
yes.
is to do the right thing, and that is to tell the truth.
Yeah. Well said, Frank. Frank, thanks for calling and sharing your story with us. It's great to be in touch with you. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, up next. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and free-don.org. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
By the way, Victoria, just a heads up for you. There's news on the Don Siegelman front. He's got a hearing on the 15th of this month. You might want to check out free-don.org and start, you know, get... I think it's... He may be making news very shortly. It might be worth covering in some of your reports.
I'll check that out.
Thank you. So what's going on in the world?
A great deal. The Justice Department is not reopening an investigation into the CIA's treatment of suspected terrorist detainees, despite the Senate panel's damning report on their practices. Investigators have reviewed the Intelligence Committee's report and did not find any new information that they had not previously considered in reaching their determination to dismiss the previous investigations, the Justice Department has said.
Now, what's our response going to be to Ben Emmerson, the UN's special rapporteur on torture, who has called for the prosecution of basically George W. Bush and everybody from him on down?
Yes, I think that will be interesting, and I suspect our response will be not going to do it.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll block the UN from doing it because we sit on the Security Council.
Exactly. I would, if it gets that far.
No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. It's not even going to get that far. This is why I am so totally with Anthony Romero of the ACLU, whose op-ed yesterday in the New York Times said, just pardon Bush. List his crimes so there's no ambiguity and everybody knows for all of history this guy was a war criminal, both Bush and Cheney, and then pardon them so that we can put this behind us. But anyhow, back to you.
And the White House is not saying today whether President Obama would sign the $1.1 trillion spending bill unveiled by House Republicans, Josh Earnest telling reporters today. But did say it was pleased that lawmakers do seem to be coalescing around a proposal that would avert a government shutdown. However, we should point out that a government shutdown has not yet been averted, because both House Democrats and House Republicans left their own closed-door separate meetings split over whether to support the bill crafted by House Republican appropriators. House Republicans in particular are mulling and wondering what to do, and it's not clear. There are apparently, to quote one House Republican, dozens and dozens, maybe 50 or 60 conservatives who are considering voting no on this bill. So they would need Democrats who are unhappy about some provisions in the bill. So we don't know what's going to happen on that. If it passes, it goes to the Senate, where there would likely be a vote on Friday. Oh, if it gets to a vote, because as you know, procedurally, any one senator can slow things down.
And Ted Cruz has been threatening to. Has he stopped making those threats?
No.
Hmm.
Not.
So is the conventional wisdom or the word on the street here in D.C. that Ted Cruz is going to blow this thing up or not?
I think the word is that somebody's going to do something, but it's not clear yet who.
Somebody's going to do something to force a government shutdown.
To slow it down, yeah. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said on the Senate floor today that they should expect to be working into the weekend.
Yeah, that was what I said this on the air yesterday. And my guess was that if Ted Cruz said, we're going to take multiple votes and 30 hours of debate, that Harry Reid would simply say, okay, that's fine. We don't leave on Thursday. We leave on Sunday.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Interesting decision today. Federal Appeals Court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Manhattan, made a fascinating decision, overturned two of the government's signature insider trading convictions, a stunning blow to prosecutors and their campaign to root out illegal activity on Wall Street. It's considered a decision that could rewrite the course of insider trading law, sharply curtailing its boundaries. Basically, what they said was at issue was whether a trader to be found guilty of insider trading, they said, must have known a tip was illegally disclosed in exchange for a reward. And on Wednesday, the Second Circuit said definitively that such knowledge is required, and that the two guys in the case, Todd Newman and Anthony Chiasson, were too far down the line. They were like the fourth people to know about it, and that they didn't know. And it really ups the bar on these prosecutions, and it's going to make it much, much more difficult to prosecute.
Wow.
So that's really, I think, quite fascinating.
Yeah.
The chairman of the House Select Committee on Benghazi. Yes.
Oh. Pardon, I'm sorry. I thought I had muted my microphone. Back to you, Victoria.
Yeah. The chairman of the House Select Committee on Benghazi said today, that's Representative Trey Gowdy, that his panel will produce a comprehensive account of the September 11th, 2012 attack. He said, I remain keenly aware that there are those on both sides of the aisle who have concluded all questions have been answered. There's nothing left to do. He said, but it's worth noting some of those same folks who now tell us to move on did not believe we should have investigated Benghazi in the first place. And he said they wouldn't move on until there's a complete understanding that we will have hearings in January, February, March, and until there's a full understanding of what happened in Benghazi.
I had a caller raise a question about that, and I'm curious your take on it. She suggested that, in this context of all these black sites, Benghazi, we know there was a CIA station there. Is it possible that either it was or the local people thought it was a black torture site, and that the reason that they attacked was to free their compatriots?
It's possible. Although the House Intelligence Committee did not think so, because they did not think that the locals knew about it. Also, the extremely detailed, excellent New York Times report last December did not seem to think so either.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Also, the Nebraska Humane Society found a sheep wandering around Omaha wearing a Christmas sweater.
Hmm.
Called Gage and returned him to his rightful owner Tuesday night.
Oh, that's sweet. Okay. A nice note to end the news with. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great evening. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to get back to our conversation about, torture in the Bush administration and the Obama administration, all that kind of thing, and other news of the day in about 25 minutes. But Dan Sisson is with us, the co-author of the new book, The American Revolution of 1800, actually the original author. He wrote this book 40 years ago. And then Dan and I went through it over the course of the last 3 years or so and just kind of brought it up to date and it's now been reissued and it's out, The American Revolution of 1800. Dan is the distinguished professor of American history and the revolution coming our way at the Tom Hartman University on the banks of the Potomac. He is more famously the adjunct faculty member at Eastern Washington University, where he teaches the history of technology in the engineering department. And many thanks to the good folks at the Eastern Washington University for bringing Dan to us. Hey, Dan.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm well. Welcome back. So,
thank you.
So this is our book club. We're doing this every week. We're going through this book, and you all are, this is Tom Hartman University book club analysis here. I'm going to start doing this in a lot of books. I think this is really cool. So we're up to chapter 6, Dan.
That's right.
And refresh my memory, what was the title of chapter 6?
Well, it's the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, and it's the attacks against the First Amendment.
Okay. So, first of all, taxes, T-A-X-E-S, were a big part of the public's attitude toward revolution or colonial history. Was the Revolution of 1800, the election of Thomas Jefferson, our third president, was that any different?
No. As a matter of fact, when you think about revolution, you always think about taxes, and if you go back to the colonial period, you see that there was a major struggle between what were called external taxes and internal taxes. And the external taxes were from the British Empire, from 3,000 miles away, and the internal taxes were the ones that the colonists voted themselves in their legislatures. And so when you look at 1800, one of the things that you find out is that when the Adams administration came in, that Hamilton and Oliver Wolcott and a bunch of other cronies convinced Adams that he should start raising taxes. So what he did was he established the U.S. Navy, and he gave extra appropriations to the Army, and then they started talking about a land tax, and then pretty soon they were talking about a window tax, and then after that they were talking about a carriage tax and a horse tax and a collar tax for the horses, and it was going on and on, and pretty soon the colonists, the young Americans, this is in the first decade of their nation, were saying, what's going on here? I mean, this is just like the British Empire, and we're not going to stand for it, and we don't want to have all these taxes.
Hmm.
And so this is the frame of mind that Madison and Jefferson realized was going to be against the national government, and what they had to do was to try to give it definition, just like they had at the time of the American Revolution.
Thus, many of the anti-tax folks today quote Jefferson, because Jefferson had quite a few screeds against taxes.
Hey, sure, I think we've got it in reverse. I mean, think about this for a minute. The people who are protesting the most are the corporations. The corporate leaders are the ones that are getting out of all the taxes by going abroad And we've got to reverse this trend, and so we can establish it in the American tradition. We've got it wrong. We've got to get it back.
So Jefferson was in favor of taxing people?
No. Jefferson was against it because he didn't want to see the power of the central government increase.
Right.
Right. And so
which is kind of inconsistent with where we're at today.
It is, if unless you start to connect this idea with the notion of federalism and control, which I think that this is what the chapter is really about, is to try to give a comprehensive view of the way that Madison and Jefferson began to explore ways to get the idea of revolution accepted by going into, say, things like taxation.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, there's some terms that are used in Chapter 6 of the American Revolution of 1800. Secession, compact theory, states' rights, natural rights theory. You want to define these and tell us what they had to do with Jefferson's idea of revolution?
You bet. And that's good questions. And I think that this is the key to understanding what Jefferson and Madison were up to. If you think about it for a minute, we never heard those terms. Nobody talked about secession. We did talk about natural rights theory at the time of the revolution, and what we were doing was to grounding our basic government theory in human nature and the idea that for the last 2,000 years, the people had come to be the dominant force in the government. That is, no government could take away the rights of the people. You couldn't just simply proclaim that the people had no right to vote in an election. And the idea of secession was something that could only happen when you had a government divided into separate sovereignties, that is, the states and the federal government. And so if you were going to secede from the federal government, you had to think about that in terms of the relationship between the government and subordinates and equals. And so people were encouraged to think about what rights they had under the form of government and authority that they were turning to for support. And this is all reflection now. In other words, Jefferson is not advocating at this point any immediate action to, you know, start firing on government soldiers or whatever. What he's trying to do, and Madison does a brilliant job of this too, is to get people to think about their natural rights. And this is a major one. The compact theory was another one in which we people began to think of the Constitution as a compact and that the Philadelphia Convention as a way in which people agreed on certain powers that would be given to the government, but also certain powers that would be reserved to the states. And in those days, in the 19th century, the turn of the 19th century, most people's lives were centered around their communities. They didn't have anything to do with the federal government. I mean, you never saw a senator or a president or anybody. So that for all practical purposes, it was the local and state governments that were your government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, remarkable. Why was the Alien Sedition Law a major? This was in the 2 years before the end of the John Adams administration.
That's right.
Why was that a major turning point for Jefferson and Madison in their opposition, not just to John Adams, but also to Alexander Hamilton?
That's the right connection, because Hamilton and his friends in the legislature were able to write a bill. And we have a letter that Hamilton wrote in 1798 upon the actual printing of the bill. He saw one of the first copies. And his comment was, "I have just seen a bill that will pose a major problem and possibly civil war." And so Hamilton endorsed that. Yeah, he said later on, he said, "We should bring the Alien and Sedition Bill to the fore, not in such a way that we're going to encourage faction to violence, but as a test of force." And what he meant by that was that he knew that the Alien Bill was an attempt to keep Jefferson's supporters from being here. They could be arrested and then deported. I mean, if this sounds familiar, then this is history repeating itself. Yeah. But with the Sedition Bill, this was a much more serious matter. James Madison, remember, he's the father of our Constitution, probably understood as much of it as anybody, if not more. He was alarmed at this, and he said that this represents the first signs that the opposition intends to become a permanent factor in the government, that they are not going to be open to elections. He knew that Hamilton was waiting in the wings to be able to put himself in a position to be the general in charge, and they were worried about the drift towards the
British. Hamilton and Adams were basically raising a kingdom within the United States.
That was the main fear.
Yeah, remarkable. Dan Sisson is with us. He's the author of The American Revolution of 1800, a new book. He is Distinguished Professor of American History and the Revolution Coming Our Way here at the Tom Hartman University on the banks of the Potomac. He's also an adjunct faculty member at Eastern Washington University, where he teaches the history of technology in the engineering department. We'll be back with Dan right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And at the bottom of the hour, we will be picking up your calls and getting back to, you know, everything from the Confederate flag to torture. Stick around. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Dan Sisson with us. Dan, how did the idea of nullification give Jefferson's revolution a big boost in the eyes of the public? And by the way, I'll get to that in a minute.
Well, I think that, American history has sort of stained the idea of nullification because it's identified with the Southern cause of slavery and John C. Calhoun. But if you take it as a matter of constitutional theory and you try to figure out a way in which you can get citizens to think about the Constitution in relationship to its powers, this was the genius of Jefferson's notion. Nullification implies that you have the ability to nullify a law at a level of government. So if you have a federal level and you also have a state level, and they're passing two different laws, if the law at the federal level turns out to be obnoxious, such as excessive taxation, then you can choose simply to ignore it. And if you think about it in terms of our citizenry and their objections, say, to a rising gasoline tax or, you know, a tax on roads or something, it may be in their interest to do this, but they don't want to pay that tax. And so you empower them to think about what role the government should play. And, if, you know, you look around us today in the 21st century, and one of the things we find out, there's this appalling lack of ignorance about the Constitution, about the way that that document conveys powers to the state and the residual powers to the people. And we don't teach enough of this stuff in the class. I mean, you're the one who said there's only 9 states that are teaching civics in the nation.
Or right that now. Require it to graduate from high school, yeah.
Yeah, and so we need to get people thinking about the Constitution and what powers it gives and where they're located and how they're used. And this, I think, is one of the geniuses of Jefferson's suggestion. It was too bad and unfortunate in later American history that the term was sullied, you know, by slavery and the slaveholders.
Well, even post-slavery, you've got people now in the militia movements using the word nullification. Do they mean something fundamentally different than Jefferson did?
They talk about, like, the governor of Texas declared he wanted Texas to secede. That's the extreme version of nullification.
Right.
I don't hear too much, sensible, rational talk from the people who are, using that term, you know, like, say, the Cliven episode, you know, in the BLM.
Yeah.
Right. And, it's a matter of force. And it seems to me that there are ways, like, say, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, that people, they need to educate a larger body of people until they become a majority under our constitutional system. And that's the challenge. And I think for Madison and Jefferson in 1798, 1799, this is exactly how they saw it. They said, we got to get people interested, excited, and in motion about defending their rights.
Yeah.
And so what better way than to say, from a constitutional point of view, you have rights and you've got to be aware of them and you've got to be able to articulate them and know deep down that they can't be taken away. And so here we see, people being denied the right to vote in our country by the millions.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Well, we're talking with Dan Sisson, the author of The American Revolution of 1800. We'll be right back. just past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan Sisson on the line with us, the author of The American Revolution of 1800. And this is the Tom Hartman University Book Club. We are up to chapter 6 now in the book. And Dan, before we continue with the details of chapter 6 in this book, you're quite the scholar of early American history and certainly the era around 1800. What would Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, for that matter, John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, what would they have thought about this torture report that just came out from the Senate Intelligence Committee?
I can't speak for Hamilton, although everything about Hamilton would indicate he was an honorable man, except for his ambition for power. But there's never any approval at any point by any of the founding fathers and their entire generation that I know of that would be in favor of torture. In fact, General Washington, in command of the Revolutionary Army, gave an explicit order in which he said that British soldiers captured and officers would not be tortured under any circumstances. This is something that was absolute, and there was evidence to indicate that they had done that to the colonists. And so if that is the idea that permeates that generation, then, you know, they would be appalled. And yeah. I think they would also make one more connection. I do not believe that we can be a nation that advocates torture of potential enemies or people that we capture and still maintain the respect for American ideals around the world. It's incompatible.
I agree. Now, let's just acknowledge, though, that many of the founders were slaveholders, and that was a particularly brutal form of torture. And that, you know, people like the son of John Adams, you know, John Quincy Adams, who just led the fight, particularly after his presidency, when he went back to the House of Representatives, to end that, pointed out that it was torture. And the rest of the world was pointing to us and saying, you guys are torturing your African, your African American slaves. And that, arguably, that torture stained that era, that generation, and we're still dealing with it.
I think we're dealing with it more forthright now in the 21st century than we were dealing with it in the 18th century.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Remember, yeah, this is a culture that was inherited by the leaders of the revolution.
Right.
One could even make the argument, I believe, that by basing the society on natural rights and, say, Locke's ideas and, to say, democracy and the notion of equality, that we were paving the way, you know, for a system in which we treat everybody equally, and we're still working at it. I mean, yeah. Ferguson, to me, is an illustration of how far we have to go and what we have to do to make sure that the minority African-based population feels accepted in this society.
Yeah. Yeah, and arguably these founders wrote the end of slavery into the Constitution, and certainly Jefferson on many occasions fought hard to end slavery. Being a slave
12 times, Tom.
Yeah. Pardon?
12 times.
12 times.
He tried to introduce it into legislative bodies, and he was rebuffed by a majority.
Yeah, remarkable. Madison, well, first of all, what's an interregnum? You know, the charge of an interregnum was made during the Adams administration, and it freaked out Americans. I don't think most people even know what the word is, much less that something like that happened back then.
Right. Well, the interregnum refers to a period in English history in the 17th century. Remember, this is less than 120 years before our revolution, in which the suspension of normal parliamentary government procedure took place. And Cromwell came in with his army into the parliament chambers and with a regiment of troops and said, get rid of that silly bobble and all these people in here. And they were chased out at the point of bayonets. And from that point on, he was the dictator. Well, the people in 1798, 1799, when this term starts to be bandied about, they were suggesting that Hamilton, who was the inspector general of the U.S. Army, was now pushing for a show of force with Virginia because of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, and that they were going to refuse to have elections, that they would just simply say, we're going to postpone them, and if you did that, then you would be destroying the Constitution. So right. that the alarm had to do with the absolute regularity of our Constitution guaranteeing our freedoms. Now, that's what it's about.
Didn't Jefferson write the Kentucky resolutions in secret, basically?
Yeah, he dreamed them up and he wrote them out, and then he gave them to one of his good friends, John Breckinridge, who was the leader of the Kentucky Assembly, to introduce them into the legislature.
What did they say?
Well, they were all those terms that we were talking about a little while ago about nullification and secession and natural rights, mm-hmm. and examining that idea of federalism. I mean, these are circular arguments that keep coming back in different forms to get people to think about their rights. And so both Madison and Jefferson were saying that the germ of the idea of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions was to excite reflection. That is, to get people to think.
And what a novel idea.
Yeah, it is. And when you look around at our politicians, that's the last thing in the world they want us to do is think. Or the radio programs. There's hardly anything that is not just the propaganda value.
Yeah. Everything's been reduced to bumper stickers.
Yeah.
We have about a half a minute left. The main carry home from chapter 6 of the American Revolution of 1800, Dan.
The main carry home is that if you want to have a viable society based on a constitution, you have to engage in a relentless and continuous educational policy that makes people aware of their rights and responsibilities and obligations under the Constitution and how they are being translated into law.
Remarkable. Dan Sisson, the author of The American Revolution of 1800, our book of the, it's been more than a month, the book that we're doing with our book club here at the Tom Hartman University. Dan, thank you.
I love it, Tom, and thank you very much.
Great talking to you. We'll see you next week for Chapter 7. And we'll be back with your calls right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Is the Confederate flag racist? Is torture going to save us? Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. We have heard from Andrea Tentero of Fox, well, actually, you know, just by tape, saying America is awesome. And people are just talking about torture because they want to hurt George Bush's reputation, I guess, or something to that effect. Apropos of that, and then we heard from Matthew Heimbach, the White Student Union, saying that he loves the Confederate flag and wants the state of Texas to put it on his car as a license plate holder. Which is, you know, having the stars and bars on a license plate. This is an official speech by the state, not just by Matthew. So I'm going to be picking up your calls on that. Before I get to that, though, I just wanted to share with you something. This is from September 14, 1775. This is 9 months before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. We were already engaged in hostilities with the British. Okay, the American Revolution didn't just start with the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So here we are 9 months earlier, and George Washington is the head of the Continental Army, and he writes a letter to one of his leaders, one of the leaders of his soldiers, who's taking soldiers up into and through the northern part of the United States and into Canada, through the Indian Territory in Canada. That soldier's name was Benedict Arnold, but this was before the great turncoat thing. Benedict Arnold was actually one of our most decorated military men in the early 1770s, in 1775. And this is the letter that George Washington wrote to him. I'm just going to read you a few pieces from this. Keep in mind, this is, you know, fairly archaic language. I'll have to translate some of it, I suppose. But, "Sir, you are entrusted with a command of the utmost consequence, sequence to the interests and liberties of America." In other words, you're what you are doing, the command that you have, is going to reflect on us. And he says, "Upon your conduct and courage, and that of the officers and soldiers detached on this expedition, not only the success of the present enterprise and your own honor, but the safety and welfare of the whole continent may depend. In other words, you, Benedict Arnold, leading these soldiers, the way you behave may determine the fate and future of the United States of America, or the possibility even of it emerging. Keep in mind, this is even before we signed the Declaration of Independence. He said, consider yourselves as marching not through an enemy's country, but through that of friends and brethren. Check by every motive of duty and fear of punishment. And keep in mind, he's saying, you know, this is how you're going to stop your soldiers from behaving badly. Check by every motive of duty and fear of punishment every attempt to plunder or insult any of the inhabitants of Canada. Should any American soldier be so base and infamous as to injure any Canadian or any Indian in his person or his property, I do most earnestly enjoin you, ask you, beg you, to bring him to severe and exemplary punishment. If one of your soldiers mistreats a prisoner or mistreats anybody on this trip, punish him. Should that punishment extend to death itself, it will not be disproportional to its guilt at such a time and in such a cause. In other words, this is such a critical moment. If your soldiers screw up the reputation of the Americas, of the United States, by treating people badly, you may sentence them to death. Should it extend to death itself, it will not be disproportional to its guilt at such a time and in such a case, but I hope and trust that the brave men who have voluntarily engaged in your expedition will be governed by far different views. That order, discipline, and regularity of behavior will be conspicuous as their courage and valor. Upon the whole, sir, I beg you to inculcate upon the officers and soldiers the necessity, he capitalizes the word necessity, of preserving the strictest order during their march through Canada, to represent to them the shame, disgrace, and ruin to themselves and countries if they should, by their conduct, turn the hearts of the brethren in Canada against us. In other words, do not do that. Do not turn them against us. And on the other hand, the honors and rewards which await them, our soldiers, if by their prudence and good behavior, they conciliate the affections of the Canadians and Indians to the great interests of America and convert those favorable dispositions they have shown into a lasting union and affection. George Washington, if Benedict Arnold had tortured or waterboarded people in Canada or Indians on the way, George Washington would have executed him. He gave an explicit command to Arnold Benedict that if any of the soldiers in your employ treat your prisoners of war badly, execute them. Amazing. Jerry in Athens, Georgia. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey there. I want to talk about the Sons of the Confederacy. I'm a Southern man. My folks moved here in the 1700s mm-hmm. from Scotland and settled in Alabama. So I was raised in the South. And I had a Confederate flag on the front of my car until I was about 17 years old when I just, 18 year old, just started college. And a philosophy professor who was black saw that tag on my car and he said, "What does that mean to you?" And I said, "That's heritage. I'm proud of it." He said, "Let me tell you what it means to me." And you can guess what he said. It means hate.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think. And it made me realize that it doesn't matter what it means to me. I know who I am. But it does matter what it means to other people. And it's offensive. And I can say that I gained the maturity, as I hope this other man will, to realize that that's important, not to be offending other people. In Georgia, we had the stars and bars on our flag for many, many years, and it was changed. And now what our flag is the real Confederate flag, and many people don't realize that, with the great seal of Georgia, which seems to offend no one.
Right.
There's a lesson to be learned from that.
There is. Jerry, you are literally a gentleman, and, well, you're not a soldier, I guess, but you are quite literally a grown-up. I mean, what an adult statement. Thank you, Jerry, so much for calling and sharing
story.
That was profound. Thank you. Audrey in Richton Park, Illinois. Hey, Audrey.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's up?
Hello, Tom, can you hear?
I hear you just fine, yeah.
Okay. I was calling regarding the Confederate flag issue.
Sure.
The guy, your guest, and my personal opinion.
Oh, geez. I am so sorry. I put my hand on the wrong button, and I just dropped the caller. Please, it was Audrey, as I recall. Please call us right back, and we'll put you right back on. Kevin in New Lenox, Illinois. When I dropped her, it flipped to you. So you're on the air, Kevin.
Well, I'm a lucky guy, I guess. Well, hey, Tom, I got a quick story about flying offensive flags.
Yeah.
Let me take you back to the late 1960s. I was probably 11 or 12. I was over at a friend's house. His parents were gone. He says, hey, let's go look at my father's World War II souvenirs, for lack of a better word. And so we started rummaging through these things and came across a huge Nazi flag, you know, the red flag with a swastika on it.
Hmm.
And my friend says, hey, let's take it out of the backyard and waste it up a flagpole. I thought, well, that's a great idea. That'll be fun. Let's go do that. So we did. Tom, within 5 minutes, there were two squad cars, some very upset policemen. Obviously, someone in the neighborhood took great offense, and they should have. The police made sure that our parents were made aware of what we did, and my father sat me down that night, who was also a World War II veteran from the European theater, and explained to me, you know, why it was offensive.
Right.
Actually, the only time he'd ever talked to me about his service. So, and I guess in a bizarre way, it kind of opened up something between me and my father. And if I could just say a quick thing about the Confederate flag, Tom, that obviously the message of hate is there. But there's something also that's in there that your guest and folks of his ilk are saying when they fly that flag. They're saying, hey, my ancestors were traitors to the USA, and
right.
I'm proud of it.
Right. Yeah, that's
Lord
one.
Almighty.
Yeah, that's one dimension of it that I failed to bring up with Matthew, and I wish I had. You know, are you really proud of sedition? Are you really proud of treason? Because that's what this flag was the flag of. Thank you to Kevin. Thanks for the call. Audrey in Richland Park, Illinois. Let's try it again, Audrey. I promise I'll keep my hands off the keyboard this time.
Okay, thank you. I was saying that he was just issuing one straw man argument after another because in and of itself, that Confederate flag is a straw man argument. It represents the people. You know, abolition was about acknowledging the humanity of all human beings, including Negroes in America. And so it's getting that humanity acknowledged and protected, our rights protected. Whereas the Confederacy was arguing, you know, that feckless argument of ages, states' rights, and saying that our humanity should be acknowledged on a state-by-state basis, you know, determined really on a state-by-state basis,
right.
Rather than protected and acknowledged all over this country.
Yeah, that was the essence of Jim Crow. Although I'm astonished that you used that word to describe African Americans, but I get your point.
Right, and my thing is too. I don't know why he's trying to treat this like this is an old issue.
Mm-hmm.
That was race based.
Audrey. Audrey is on a cell phone that just croaked. So, Audrey, I'm sorry, your phone just disintegrated, which was, I guess, timely because we're hitting a break. Audrey, thanks for the call. Thanks for calling back. And I'm glad the second time that it was your phone, not mine, that took out the call. We'll be back with more of your thoughts, my thoughts, the news of the day, Confederate flags, are they racist? Do we really need to be going there? In this country, I mean, isn't it time to kind of tone things down? And the CIA, I mean, what are they trying to cover?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And maybe that's even a lousy metaphor, given the fact that they were doing rectal feeding to these poor prisoners. CIA, well. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Charles in Hamilton, Texas. Hey, Charles, you're on the air. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I wanted to weigh in on the issue of the swastikas and the rebel flags.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should be careful not to confuse the symbols with the underlying attitudes.
Right.
Just getting rid of the symbols is not going to change anyone's attitude.
Oh, I agree. But the argument here is not whether somebody should fly a Confederate flag, a Stars and Bars, or not. The argument is whether a state, in this case the state of Texas, should officially produce a license plate that has the stars and bars on it. In other words, should a state promote as part of its official function that logo which represents both treason and slavery? And I'm of the opinion that they should not. Matthew Heimbach is of the opinion that they should.
Right. As a citizen of Texas, you know, I agree with that the state or a federal agency should not ever be allowed to adopt one of these symbols.
Yeah.
You know, it's just for private individuals or institutions.
Yeah, I'm not trying to regulate what private individuals do. I'm a big fan of individual liberty. But I do think that we need to have some control and regulation over the behavior of our governments. And when a state government starts promoting a divisive, racist symbol, I think we've got a problem. Charles, thoughtful comment. Thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, I got an issue with the torture methods.
Yeah.
Since when did our government interrogation policies become policies of perverts? Because that's the way I look at it.
You're talking about the rectal feeding?
Yeah, the rectal feeding. And on the flag, that doesn't represent slavery to me. What that represents is treason. You took up arms against my ancestors.
Right.
And we were good enough to forgive you and pay off your debts.
Good
and
point.
Now you want to rub that flag in our face?
Good point. Good point. So not only African Americans should be offended, all Americans should be offended.
Yes, because there were more men killed in the Civil War than in all the wars in history. And they were Americans.
Well, it was about 600,000 men were killed in the Civil War. That can't be all of wars in history. But it was the bloodiest war in terms of American losses. It was the bloodiest war on North America in the history of the United States as a proportion of our population. But I would assert that the bloodiest war in our history was probably the Native American genocide.
The what one?
The Native American genocide. We took an entire continent that was fully populated. There was no place in this country where there was not a Native American tribe living. You can visit the Smithsonian History Museum of the Native American, and they've got maps that show where every tribe was. And there literally was not a square foot of this country that was not occupied by Native Americans somehow, someplace. And we killed them all off. Or not all of them, but very, very many of them. I would say that was actually the bloodiest war in our history. But, you know, we don't talk about that so much because it was a racist war and we're all embarrassed by it and the Native Americans are not pushing it in our face. Corky, thank you for the call. Although this move to change the name of the Washington, D.C. NFL team, I think is bringing that issue to the fore, and that's a good thing. We'll be back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am well. I hope you are, too.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, just a few comments on your guest. The thing about it is, Tom, he doesn't care that slavery was immoral. And he fully understands that slavery was immoral. And the thing about it is he calls his ancestors martyrs. Now, for my people, his ancestors were terrorists.
Right.
So, and for the United States government, who changed their minds and decided that slavery was immoral and they were going to fight against immorality.
Right.
But
they were not only terrorists, they were traitors.
Right. So, a freedom fighter and a martyr to him is a terrorist for my people.
Yeah.
So hopefully he will grow up and mature as he gets older and realize that it's okay to love your ancestors and the people that came before you. But if they represented genocide and keeping another people in chains, just because of the color of their skin, then he should not be celebrating that.
Right.
So So that's the whole thing. He has to realize that he should not be celebrating that. And is he saying that the stars and bars should be on license plates in Texas?
Yeah, that's the argument. The state of Texas said no, and they're suing the state of Texas now to say, wait a minute, this is a freedom of speech issue.
Okay, well, all this is we don't give a damn about the Indian genocide. We don't give a damn about slavery. Matter of fact, we wish you were back. That's what they really say.
Yeah.
Okay, Tom, I'll hang up. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. Well said. Anthony in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hey, Tom, good talking with you. I believe in the last couple of months, the state of the California legislature did pass some legislation signed by Governor Brown that banned the display of the Confederate flag on state properties. Hmm. I believe I read that right.
Yeah.
And as far as the personal use of the flag goes, I would just implore people who do feel like that's their right. You know, we have, you know, many rights. But I would just implore those people to try to look inside your heart and try to understand that though you may have their right to display that flag or use that flag, just try to think of the impact it has on other people. You know, just kind of step outside yourself for a moment.
Yeah. You're asking, Anthony, you're asking people to behave like adults, and not everybody does. But
yeah, I know, but if you don't try.
Yeah, I think you said it very well. Anthony, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Kenneth in Perrington, Michigan. Hey, Kenneth.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
I just wanted to say I agree with you on the torture thing, your opinion of it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'd like to add, though, is this could be a defining moment.
In what? Excuse for me. What?
For Obama. To handle this correctly.
Oh, I think if he were to issue a pardon, it would be historic.
Absolutely.
It would just be absolutely historic. And I have not heard anything out of the White House that they're not going to do that. The Justice Department.
I sure hope they do.
Yeah, the Justice Department has said that they're not going to go after these people based on this study because it doesn't say anything they didn't already know, which I thought was interesting. I mean, that's a very interesting comment coming out of the administration. But this idea of pardoning Bush, we need to start a nationwide movement to pardon Bush and Cheney. Maybe make some bumper stickers that say pardon Bush and Cheney for war crimes or for pardon Bush and Cheney for torture. And, people will see that on your car and go, is that guy Republican? I think it'd be hysterical. Kenneth, thank you for the call. Jerry in Santa Fe. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I lived in Memphis, Tennessee for 40 years, and the word conservative meant nothing but racist, and the battle flag, I don't think it's the stars and bars, the battle flag meant only one thing, and it meant I don't like black people.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that in the South.
Thank you. You're welcome. I think you're absolutely right, Jerry. Edwin in Cedar Park, Texas. Hey, Edwin.
Hey, Tom. You're great, man. I appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I have a question about this pardoning of Bush.
Right.
I got a book called Getting Away with Torture by Christopher Pyle, and it's got a picture in here that shows Bush signing a bill on October 17, 2006, granting amnesty to him and his subordinates for acts of torture. So my question is, didn't he just pardon himself?
Really?
I mean,
a president cannot pardon himself. I mean, I'm not familiar with that. How can I find that document that you're talking about?
It's in a book called Getting Away with Torture by Christopher H. Pyle, P-Y-L-E.
Okay, got it. I'll have to
look
at that.
He urges the Congress to overturn that
right.
law and pursue, you know,
yeah. Yeah, maybe somebody in our chat room can track it down. How are we doing on time, Shane? Oh, 30 seconds. Cool. Okay. Edwin, thank you for that. Andrea in Palm Springs, California. You got 30 seconds. Quick one.
Yes. In addition to the first two steps leading to the pardon of Bush and company, I believe, as with South Africa that had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission following apartheid, that's what we need to have. And I don't think that would take – I think the president could authorize that.
I agree, although – well, the president could authorize it, but he couldn't make it happen. It would require an appropriation by Congress. And the Republicans in the House and the Senate will not appropriate one penny for something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Mm.
You know, they are so desperately trying to save legacy of George W. Bush and tarnish the legacy of Barack Obama. Andre, thank you for the call. Excellent idea. That's absolutely excellent idea. It's just, you know, the political reality is tragic. So thanks so much for being with us today. Remember, when you hear somebody saying, releasing this report is going to hurt the image of America, what they're really saying is releasing this report is going to hurt the image of George W. Bush. Because the reality is releasing the report enhances the image of America. It tells the world that we are a country that actually believes in accountability and the rule of law and human rights. We may not always act that way, but when we act wrong, we fix it. Tag, you're it. Help us out. You know, pass the word. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.